Project Curate, a Houston-based organization that focuses on issues at the intersections of religion, race, and social equity. She recently completed... Dr. Davenport, yes, in religion from Rice University, where her research interests included Black religion, aesthetics, and visual culture. She also has an MDiv from the Candler School of Theology, where she was awarded the G. Ray Jordan Award for Excellence in Ministry and Scholarship. In 2011, Jessica was awarded a doctoral fellowship with the Fund for Theological Education. Biko Mandela Gray is Assistant Professor of Religion at Syracuse University, also Dr. Gray. His research interests are race, religion, philosophy of religion, and social justice. He's currently working on a book on Black Lives Matter and religion. And I'll toss it over to them.
Right, okay. Good afternoon, everybody. Am I okay, Roy? Yeah, okay. So we're just gonna kind of muse this afternoon. We have some things prepared, but it is very raw. These are kinds of our musings that we're just putting out to share with you all. And we're going to talk kind of generally speaking about the interconnections between ideas of race and friendship and how they show up in visual art and also the politics of the art world. So I'm going to begin, and then Biko is going to follow me. I want to begin with Audre Lorde. If my clicker, if I can get my clicker together.
Click on to see if we can.
Yeah, my thumb. It's not doing magic. Okay, so I want to begin with Audre Lorde, who was a monumental Black feminist lesbian writer, who wrote both prose and poetry with unflinching precision. In one of my favorite essays written by Lorde entitled Eye to Eye, she writes what is perhaps equal parts a love letter to Black women and an admonishment concerning Black women's relationships with one another. For Lorde, Black women's bonds, connections, and intimacies with one another, our ability to reach out to one another across the landscape of our varied differences and similarities, our ability to look at each other eye to eye, at the deepest levels, must be intentionally nurtured, must be cultivated. Lorde writes, we have to consciously study how to be tender with each other until it becomes a habit. Because what was native has been stolen from us, the love of Black women for each other. Lorde's essay, to be sure, is a celebration of the beauty and power of Black women's bonds. But it also goes further than that. Lorde situates these bonds as an ethic, as a practice, that in the context of our everyday encounters with both the obvious and the subtle violences of racism and sexism, it is a practice that is essential to our very survival. The great American canon of Black women's fiction goes further to attest to this ethic of community, relational bonds, connection, and intimacy. For instance, those of you who are familiar with Zora Neale Hurston's Their Eyes Were Watching God will know that it is a tale of protagonist Janie's self-discovery and her love of many men. But importantly, it is in and through Janie's bond and deep trust that she has with her friend Phoebe that she even tells her story. In Toni Morrison's Sula, we get a rich depiction of a complex friendship between Sula and Nell. It is a depiction that grapples with the emotional fallout that inevitably results when bonds of trust are cultivated between friends, but then betrayed. And in Alice Walker's The Color Purple, we find not only an unwavering connection between sisters that plays out through their letters to one another across time and continental space, but also a friendship between the characters of Celie and Shug that ultimately develops into a relationship of romantic intimacy. Indeed, the canon of Black women's literature is replete with stories of Black women's relational longings and attachments, with their complicated experiences of learning and failing, and sometimes learning again how to be, as Lorde puts it, tender with one another. As an avid reader of Black women's literature, these novels have for many years been my sacred texts. Through them, I am challenged to wrestle with what it means to be a better friend, a better partner, to be someone who is deeply accountable to my community. And yet, as a scholar of Black visual art and visual culture, the preponderance of these kinds of narratives in literature also begs the question, how are Black women's intimacies, friendships, and relational attachments accounted for in the visual field, such as photography, for instance, which is my particular interest? What might visual images that have the capacity to foreground Black women's bodies in perhaps a more immediate sense than the literal forms tell us about how friendship, intimacy, and relational attachments are distinctly embodied engagements? Now, it must be said, and I'm gonna need this clicker in a bit. Hold on for just a second, okay. Now, it must be said, I'll point to you, okay. Now, it is gonna be like a lot of movement, okay. So, speaking of embodied, okay. So, tenderness. So, but it must be said that to mine the history of photography and its depictions of Black women in an effort to engage these questions is in many ways to reckon with the history of violent intimacies. That is, when I looked back to images of Black women in the 19th century, at the dawn of photographic technology, it became evident that when they are pictured with and in relation to other people, rarely, if ever, are Black women pictured with their own families or chosen kin. With very few exceptions, they appear only in relation to the white families that enslave them. Violent intimacies. Importantly, these images are designed to project a constructed white fantasy. That is, the fantasy that forced domestic servitude and the decidedly intimate labor that it demanded of these women was normative and acceptable. Be it nursing white children from their own breast, be it working to ensure that the entire family was clean and well-fed, or be it the unspeakable sexual violences that white male owners and others enacted upon them. These images capture a type of violent intimacy. Admittedly, my use of the term intimate here is risky and likely problematic. It could give the impression that there existed some form of mutual yearning and desire. When a closer look at the women, and even some of the children that we see here, if you'll move this slide forward. It could give the impression that there existed some form of mutual yearning and desire when a closer look at the women and the children in these images suggest otherwise. And if you'll go backwards for me, Biko. Their very body language seems to short-circuit the fantasy and draw it into question, both subtly, as we see here with a slight grimace across her face, if you'll slide back one more.
So this is that was the subtle one, but also a not so subtle. Right,
with the folded arms and the cocked neck of defiance. I suppose what I'm attempting to get at in my use of the term violent intimacy in this context is a deepening of how we understand the workings of white supremacy historically and in the present moment. That is, we tend to associate racism and white supremacy with notions of exclusion, separation, and segregation. And they certainly involved all of that. But these images attest to how they are also very much constituted by orchestrated relational entanglements, attachments, and encounters. But I want to return to these momentary glimpses of somewhat wayward and unruly body language of the women in these images. While their bodies register a sense of defiant distance and dissatisfaction, they also suggest a point of possibility. They compel me to press at the limits of the photograph, as Sadia Hartman puts it, and ask what of these women's relational longings and desires exceed the frame of the image? What forms of intimacy did they perhaps secretly long for, imagine, and seek after?
Given the forced familial separations that occurred during slavery, what kinds of consensual and mutual connections might they have creatively cultivated with one another that expand ideas of kinship and family beyond the biological nuclear construction? Were there ever moments when there was the exchange of the knowing glance or a subtle gesture of affection between one another? These are questions we can only speculate about concerning the women pictured in these images, but they are questions that Black women contemporary artists have been grappling with in their works and in incredibly imaginative ways, ways that push us to rethink ideas of the singular self, the spaces and places where community happens, and our deep capacity for intimacy within the bounds of friendship. You'll go forward.
Sorry. It'll decide when it wants to.
Yeah. Yeah, let me see. So I want to get into this conversation about what Black women contemporary artists have been doing with issues of intimacy within relationships of Black women. One of them is this 2017 work by Carrie Mae Weems. Here, the artist provides what is perhaps a visual riff of Audre Lorde's notion of Black women seeing one another eye to eye. In the image, the artist employs her technique of performance as well as combining text with her images to complicate, sometimes contradict, or in this case, expand what is depicted. The image depicts a woman who happens to be R&B artist Mary J. Blige sitting in a regal throne-like chair peering at herself in a mirror. Carrie Mae Weems stands just behind her, taking the posture of both a witness and a guide to Mary J's looking exercise. You engaged in the critical act of looking, the text reads. Certainly the text can be understood as a reference to Mary J's careful self-examination of herself, and yet it also implicates Weems as well. It signals the artist's investment in Mary J's ability to really see herself as evidenced by Weems's posture and her commitment as an artist to deeply looking at Black women and the rich interiority of their lives. Importantly, the work is entitled Strength of a Woman, yet notably the image contains two women. In so doing, it troubles the popular idea of a singular strength that is cultivated in isolation of community and relationships. Despite our appearances, the image suggests, no one is self-made. If we are fortunate enough to have any strength, it is more often than not because someone, a friend, a loving partner, a mentor, has come along, stood lovingly behind us, and carefully showed us how to see it and honor it for ourselves. Nice. If you'll go forward, Biko. The work of Naima Green provides a meditation on where community, particularly Black community, happens. In her series entitled Jewels from the Hinterland, she pictures young Black people in the lush, wild greenery of natural landscapes. To be sure, Green offers an alternative depiction of Black life from the preponderance of images that associate Blackness with urban, concrete landscapes. In this particular image, two Black women sit closely together on a tree stump. They seem not only at home in nature, but also at home in one another. Move forward. Lastly, how might our experiences of meaningful, deep friendships and bonds challenge what bell hooks refers to as the hierarchy of intimacies through which we often structure our relationships? This is the question I see Lorna Simpson posing in her work, Interior, Exterior, Full, Empty. In the work, Simpson pairs still images from film with recorded dialogue. This particular image depicts two nude Black women presumably lounging together in a bathtub.
While the scene could certainly be read as sexual in nature, Simpson notes that she partially disrupts this reading by pairing the image with dialogue in which the women discuss their work and how they put it out into the world. What emerges from the piece is a kind of mutuality, vulnerability, and bare exposure that is often only reserved for the realm of romantic love. The work thus presents the possibility that our friendships can often be just as meaningful, lasting, and worthy of our intention and investment as our marriages and romantic partnerships. This is not so much to equate the two forms of relationship, but it is to account for and expand our capacities for meaningful connection wherever it shows up. So I'm actually gonna stop here and shift it a hard stop to Vico, and we'll continue the conversation about some of these themes that I brought up. He's actually gonna pick up kind of where I left off, but in a really different way. So
I would like for you all to give it up for Jessica one more time. What you'll begin to notice very quickly is that Jessica is a scholar of arts and aesthetics. I am not. And I want to be very clear about that. I am a philosopher of race and religion, and so I don't read images as deeply and with as much texture as Jessica does. So do not expect me to walk you through the depths of these images. I want to start, if you can move to the next slide, with one of Jessica and I's shared boos, Horton Spillers. If you don't know who she is, she's an incredibly literary theorist teaching at Vanderbilt University right now. She writes a piece called Mama's Baby, Papa's Maybe, and this is the first paragraph. Let's face it, I'm a marked woman, but not everybody knows my name. Peaches and brown sugar, sapphire and earth mother, auntie, granny, God's holy fool, a Miss Ebony first, or black woman at the podium. I describe a locus of confounded identities, a meeting ground of investments and privations in the national treasury of rhetorical wealth. My country needs me, and if I were not here, I would have to be invented. I'll say that one more time. My country needs me, and if I were not here, I would have to be invented. I need you sounds good. It affirms you. It tells you you're important. It feeds your ego. To be needed feels like love. And as the old saying goes, we all want to be loved. You see, Spillers knows her country needs her, but this knowledge isn't affirming. She knows necessity is a trap. She would have to be invented if she weren't here. An old philosopher once told us that I cannot understand myself without coming in contact with an other. Slave owners needed slaves. You can move me to the next slide. They are nothing without them. God, and God, for this philosopher anyway, needs the creation. God is nothing without something or someone to celebrate and enter into communion with. And I want to just stop briefly here because I love what Harmonia Rosales is doing here. She is telling us that this mutuality is possible. The philosopher that I'm speaking of does not understand this mutuality, but I wanted to disrupt our lenses with that, just with this image. Even if these relationships between slave owners and the enslaved, or between God and God's creation, even if these relationships offer benefits to both parties, privilege is always afforded to the former. God and the slave owner are always first. Necessity names power, not intimacy. To be or a violent kind of intimacy, as Jessica has pointed out. To be needed, then, is not always pleasant. It can be violent. After all, the one who is needed is always called upon to give of themselves. This is even and maybe especially in the case in friendship. When friendship is based upon need, one wonders if your friend is a friend at all. Needy friendships are toxic. They ask too much. They siphon things from you. They take life instead of giving it. You might stay, but you know it's uncomfortable. You might persist, but you know this persistence has turned into a prison. Resentment enters. The needy friend, preoccupied with their own needs, never stops to ask you if you wanted this. No one likes a needy friend, but many of us have them. You can move me to the next slide. Andy Warhol was Jean-Michel Basquiat's needy friend. I'll let that one sit for a second. We don't like to talk about it. Warhol's reputation mutes the fact that he was a succubus. So we glamorize, you can move me to the next slide. Jeffrey Deitch, an art collector in New York. We are having trouble with this. There we go. Jeffrey Deitch, and I want you to see the relationship here. Who's smiling and who is not? Jeffrey Deitch tells us that, quote, I'd never seen Andy so close with anyone, and if this is Andy's notion of proximity, my God. I'd never seen Andy so close with one, and I'd never seen Jean so close with anyone. These guys really loved each other. Glenn O'Brien reminisced, you can move me to the next slide, that Andy loved Jean-Michel like a son almost. The bromance was real, and it was widely documented. But there were questions. They didn't begin as friends. Race or racism, I'm not sure, colored their initial encounters. Andy initially found Jean-Michel repugnant. You can move me to the next slide. That thing is not working. There we go. Andy initially found Jean-Michel repugnant. Ronnie Coutrone, Warhol's longtime assistant, tells us, quote, Basquiat was a young black kid on drugs who was obnoxious, unquote. And Warhol was turned off by this. This may not have lasted, or maybe it did. Either way, Warhol eventually saw the light, and the relationship became symbiotic. Jean-Michel thought he needed Andy's fame, Coutrone remembers, and Andy thought he needed Jean-Michel's new blood. Jean-Michel gave Andy a rebellious image again, unquote. Where some saw genuine affection, others saw pragmatism. The friendship may have been genuine, but it was steeped in necessity. They needed each other. But the need wasn't balanced. It wasn't mutual. Basquiat may have received more fame and fortune through Warhol. Basquiat's need was economic, and it had its limits. But Warhol's need had no limits. You see, he needed inspiration. His career was stagnant. He was making lobster portraits. If you all know those little lobster bibs, he had a really shitty show that turned on him. And so this is 81, and then he meets Basquiat in 82. And all of a sudden, things start to turn. Warhol needed a revival, and Basquiat became his evangelist. He made Warhol relevant again. Basquiat may have been Warhol's friend, but he was also his muse, his lucky charm, his human rabbit's foot. Warhol needed Basquiat, and in more ways than one. The necessity is specific. Warhol needed Basquiat, but Warhol also needed Basquiat. I'll say that again. Warhol needed Basquiat, but Warhol also needed Basquiat. Can you hear the difference in emphasis? You can move me to the next slide. Hopefully it's this one. There it is, take his back one. Keith Haring was also influenced by graffiti, but to my knowledge, Warhol and Haring only collaborated on a few pieces, and this is the only one I could find, so maybe there are more. But with Basquiat, things took on a new face. This wasn't merely a collaboration, it was an obsession. And this obsession wasn't erotic, it was pornographic. And for those of y'all who know who Audre Lorde is, you should hear this distinction in the work. Using Basquiat's feelings, well, his whole life really, like a Kleenex, Warhol couldn't get enough. On top of collaborating with Basquiat, Warhol photographed every facet of Basquiat's life. Quote, he showed Basquiat shaving, getting dressed, lying on a bed, and trying on clothes in a boutique changing room. You can change the slide. There are images of Basquiat getting his nails painted. Take me to the next one. Photos of him wearing only a jock strap. Where am I at? There I am. Photos of him only wearing a jock strap. You can move it to the next one. Though piss had become passe, Basquiat's face was printed on one of Warhol's oxidation paintings. While Warhol was notoriously closed off, there was nothing off limits for him when it came to Basquiat. This friendship, however compassionate and profitable it may have been, was clearly not a mutual one. Basquiat tells us as much. He says, "I think I influenced him more than he influenced me." Warhol may have come first, he always came first, but he needed Basquiat. Basquiat clarified and refined and revived Warhol. Warhol found himself again in Basquiat. In needing Basquiat, Warhol was made possible. And when that necessity dried up, so did the friendship. And they stopped talking after a while. Needy friendships are toxic because they end when the need is gone. Or maybe they don't. Maybe the face has changed, but the relationship remains the same. Spillers didn't tell us, "You need me." She told us her country needs her. And the me is, as she says, offered in service of a collective function. Warhol's need, then, is not his own. He shares his neediness with others. From Bill Arnett to Keith Haring, you can move me to the next slide, but we're going to move quickly through that one. From Carl Van Vechten, you can move to the next one. From Carl Van Vechten to even Dana Schutz, even as recently as Dana Schutz. Can we get that image? The world of art has been relying upon needing black life and black death for its inspiration. You can move me to the next one. Art is not free of anti-black exploitation. In fact, much of it relies on black death for its sustenance, for its inspiration. God needs creation, it makes God possible. Slave owners needed slaves, it makes them possible. And the art world needs blackness, it makes that world possible. The former take pleasure in this need. God is adored by God's creation. The slave owner is afforded luxury through enslaved labor. And black life affords the art world aesthetic ecstasy, or at least affective release. But the needed take little, if any, pleasure in this. Making the art world possible, black art is needed. And because it is needed, if black art weren't here, it would have to be invented. I'm going to say a couple more things. Move me to the next one. No one wants a needy friend. No one wants a needy friend. But somehow, for black folks, needy friends keep showing up. So you can give me that last slide. So, tired of the toxicity, we go elsewhere. Thank you, guys. Set change time, I think. I would do a jig, but that's problematic in a host of ways. For the symmetry purpose? All right. No, it works better this way. And then we can just turn out and, yeah. All right, this just makes some moves.
Thank you so much. I feel like I want to name your generosity in sharing your work with us, the fruits of your research and thinking. Your generosity in being here, which I just think needs to be named for what it is, and also your generosity in, to be honest, giving a bunch of us here room to repent, which is an incredible grace. Hmm. It's an incredible, incredible grace. So I just want to start with that gratitude. And I feel like, yes, we're so, I know it's not nothing. And there's so much we could talk about. I think I want to go for it.
Mm-hmm. Go
so
for it.
I feel like you were very subtle and gentle with us. And I want to invite you to be more explicit. Okay? So I want to tie together two themes. The jarring theme of a violent intimacy, mm-hmm. which I think is so remarkable, and those photographs are so jarring and unsettling, and this notion of being needed. I want to name that in a way the image community has been a white dominant community mm-hmm. for 30 years. So do you worry? And I want you to be free to be honest with us. Are we needy friends? And is that a common experience for you as you engage religion, art world, the faith and arts community? Is it its own re-performance of a kind of violent intimacy despite all of our best intentions? Is that a fair question? Does that make sense?
I mean, it definitely is a fair question. Jay, you want to go for it? I'm lending it to you,
please,
child.
Do.
Yeah, you know, I, so yes, I've had the experience of having needy white friends. I try not to make a habit of that, right? So I am of the mind fairly recently that I'm not all that interested in doing the work of teaching white people about this sort of stuff, right? Google is available to
exactly.
people. And there are lots of white organizations, white-led organizations where people are doing this kind of work. And I just don't consider myself doing this kind of work with friends, right?
Yeah.
It's because it's work for me. And so when we come into spaces like this, and I kind of want to shout out Lisa again, who is just so thoughtful and really incredible. She invited us here, but didn't do it under any false pretense, right? Was very clear of the demographic of this space. And so we came ready and sort of prepared for what we would likely encounter in the way of these kinds of curiosities and neediness. But there are ways, I think, that Biko and I, given the work that we do, have learned to sort of find ways in and around that. So there are practical things that we do to make sure that that's not just so laborious for us. One of those things is, and some of the folks in our class will know this, we are always open to people coming and asking questions, you know, about issues of race and justice and that kind of thing. But we decided before we came here that we wouldn't take those questions alone, right? So that meant that it would be necessary for people to approach both Biko and I because it's just a lot of labor to do that work. I'm not willing to do it on my own. And I also need someone as sort of a witness to be able to sort of see what's happening and someone who I can talk and speak back to. So I'm not sure if I really answered your question. I mean, yes, I know what neediness is. I try not to make a habit of being friends with white people who are needy in that way.
Yeah.
And we have learned certain, I think, mechanisms of ways to kind of handle that and manage it.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. That's great.
Yeah, I just want to add a couple things. One, I'm using Warhol and Basquiat because their particular relationship has been framed as friendship. But I start with Spillers because I think neediness is a structural thing. And so,
exactly, yeah.
in addition to Jessica, she's right, we don't make a practice out of, white or black, we don't make a practice out of cultivating needy friends. We just don't, and we have been very intentional in our work together and in our work beyond the work that we do in anti-racist work to develop a kind of healthy mutuality amongst our squad. But in terms of this question of neediness more generally, Horton Spillers is very clear. My country needs me, which means that the people in this country need her, which means that people who are laying significations on her, peaches, sugar, brown sugar, God's holy fool, a black woman at the podium, a Miss Ebony First, or as if I was thinking about the names that are given to me, black man, football player, right? I don't even want to go, thug, criminal. These kinds of names that come to me speak to a kind of neediness that exceeds desire, but speaks to a kind of necessity that will always ask more of me than I can offer. And so there's a way in which we don't cultivate needy friends, but have to deal with the structure of neediness in these, even in a space like this. Where you're asked to do a kind of work that is near and dear to your heart, but you have to do so much work clearing space. So it's a kind of like, how do we finally get to the point where we can just see two girls sitting in, or two women sitting in a clearing with the green around them, without it being burdened by, oh, they're black women, and what do we think about the intersection? No, like, how do we get to the point where there's not a burden for that kind of hermeneutical lens? So I think if that helps, I'm not a fan of like getting down to like specific folks, because I'm a philosopher after all. We stay up there, yeah. But I don't want to say needy friends, but I would say the structure of neediness is something that, from my perspective, continues to structure the American society, whether that's progressive, liberal, or conservative.
Yeah, and that's what I think for some of us it will be a revelation to think of both not just the art world as a structure that exhibits that, but also the faith and art world as a system and structure that exhibits. So I just wanted to make sure that we sort of, that's not news to you guys, but it's news to some of our conversations that we're having here. So I want to come back to a theme, and this also builds on something that I think you said in a comment yesterday, which is not reducing black art to protest art. And so I'm really intrigued in this thread that you showed us in contemporary black women's photography, the deep communal, relational resources that are going on there. Is there, and this is just a question from ignorance, is that itself a testimony to a religious capital that is inherited in black communities that actually gives birth to a mutuality, a relationality, as opposed to the kind of autonomous, independent, isolated nomad monad that we experience in sort of dominant culture?
Yeah, I mean, I would say so. So what I know of black religion more broadly, I mean, my experience in my study of black religion has very much been focused on, you know, black churches and black Christianity, okay. but a bit of, you know, dibble and dabbling within the Nation of Islam and that sort of thing. But from what I know of those traditions, it is, and I think we may have discussed this during the podcast, I mean, it is deeply communal, right? Even in the way certain spaces are arranged, when we talk about when the spirit moves, it just doesn't move one person and has a way of taking over the entire, you know, church congregation. I mean, these kind of collective experiences that happen within these religious communities, I would say, yeah, I mean, there's a way in which there's some correlation there.
For sure. Because it strikes me that is saying that there's modes of kind of Christian incarnational intuition that are being lived out in the pattern, not just in what's exhibited in the work, but how the work is being generated, in a sense, if that sounds fair. Which means that it's actually...
Say a little bit more about what you mean about how the work is being generated.
Well, it seems to me... And you should tell me more. This is your work. So it strikes me that you were saying that there's sort of artistic communities behind the production of work that also exhibits and celebrates community. Sure. Yeah. No.
Riffing. Yeah. I think. I was reading recently this young woman who was writing about sort of a black feminist practice of art criticism. Mm. And the point that she was making was that she is in very, she's in deep relationships with, she's a critic, and she's in deep relationships with the artist whose work she writes about. And that is sort of pushing up against sort of normative ideas around criticism, where you have to maintain a kind of distance from and and objectivity, if that's ever even possible, when you are relating to or talking about a particular kind of work. And so her point was, how can we kind of tap into these ideas around relationality? What do they offer us in terms of our ability to critique a piece, right? To write about a piece and what's at stake at a piece. And I think Black women artists are constantly doing that, right? I mean, I think that's also something that we saw in the Mary J. Blige, Carrie Mae Weems image, that there's a relationship that's happening between them. And that's not Carrie Mae Weems having a kind of distance from the people. This is not an ethnographic study, right? She's implicating herself in the work. Yes. And the relationship that they have together, there is something that we glean from the work in that. Yeah. So between Weems, and I think it's important to note, Weems, Naima Green, Lorna Simpson, all of them are involved in these staged photographic works over and against this kind of documentary tradition in which most of them started. And their idea in that was to push against the idea that, you know, photographic images can be used for this, you know, again, distant ethnographic piece, and to be very upfront with what they're doing in their work and making some sorts of claims about it, and that photography is not just this kind of self-evident practice, but how can they use the photographic medium to engage in some discourses with one another.
Yeah. And it's like the enactment of, I think, some Christian and theological intuitions about the nature of God's own relationality. The riff on Michelangelo is such a fascinating illustration of that. But then in the way the work gets generated and what it's picturing, I think it's really powerful. Can we talk about, I do want to make sure that we make room for conversations from the audience too. Can we talk about Audre Lorde for a second though?
I'm glad you brought it up.
So two themes, and I would let you, because you both mentioned Lorde, and I think it's such a provocative way to imagine intersections with our faith interests here in the image community. Two themes, Eros. Mm-hmm. I would love for us to talk more about Eros and why Eros is not something that we should be scared of. Mm-hmm. And it strikes me that, in a way, the celebration of Eros is tied up with the celebration of embodiment that you mentioned, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Which then turns out that if you are actually going to be a tradition that takes embodiment seriously, and you say you're incarnational, you should take Eros a lot more seriously. And some folks are getting skittish at this point, but can you say more? Because then what strikes me is, if, and I don't want to overread this, but certainly Lorde suggests that it's in sort of maybe in Black traditions that are more forthright in celebrating Eros, even though she distinguishes that from porneia. Mm-hmm. So that would also mean that there's something, a lot to be learned about incarnationality and sacramentality from those traditions. I'm sorry, I'm rambling a little bit.
I'd just
love to hear you guys talk about that.
Well, I'm not going to say much. I'm going to say a little bit, but... what I want to say is that I'm going to defer to Jessica in terms of the specific trajectory. Audre Lorde is very clear that it's not simply Black communities that are participating in Eros and speaking to that, but specifically Black women.
Yeah, that's right, yes.
So that there's a very...
And Black lesbians.
And Black...
More specifically.
Let's be even clearer. So one thing that... But also the other thing is that she's reading against and beyond the Greek tradition of Eros, too. Yeah. And so she's telling us that this thing... You know, Eros gets so quickly reduced down to romantic and sexual relationships, even mutual ones. And her argument is, I'm in an erotic relationship when I'm building a bookshelf with my partner. So what do you do when she tells you that this is a creative power that speaks to sharing feelings beyond the kind of reduced embodiment that can only, as she says, see feeling as sensation? Right. So I think in certain ways, and Jessica, help me out here, because I think
you're making the distinctions. Yeah. So she does make these clear distinctions. So for Lorde, it's a problem that pornography and the erotic have often been collapsed. right? Because for her, the field of the pornographic is sensation without feeling. And the pornographic lends itself to making use of other people for this kind of empty sensation.
Piss paintings.
Yeah, whereas the erotic is deep feeling, right? And it's not so much about the doing, but it's about the feeling in the doing. And that can happen in a sexual act, or it can happen when someone is writing a poem. It can happen, as you said, building a bookshelf. I mean, she extends it out, and her argument is that should really, it's a life force, right? It should drive our work in the world. That the feelings that we have internally, that we should give some thought to them, right? And allow them to really, and give more credence to them at the very least, which certainly goes up against a lot of the doctrine within Christianity that says, you know, we have to sort of harness.
Yeah, although there is another stream of the Christian tradition in which agape is rightly ordered eros. Do you know, like I grant there's a long and wide puritanical stream, but I was thinking when you were discussing that, and then when I was reading the Lord essay again, a lot of images of medieval women saints, if you sort of took them out of context, they look orgasmic, right? And that's because there is a deep eros that's being realized now, not in a sexual relationship, but in another kind of relationship. So it seems to me like it's the sort of thing that is not antithetical. It was made antithetical, and that there's a room to imagine how those things could be integrated.
And the construction of that antithesis, I think, it can almost be tracked in modernity to the rise of white supremacy. And so the one thing that I do want to add here, in distinction from the erotic, is that the pornographic takes the voyeur's gaze. It takes Andy Warhol's gaze. Yeah. It takes, instead of being in relation with Basquiat, I'm behind a camera all the time, and I'm missing the life that is happening. And this is not taking photographs in the way that Mabu Lanicia will take photographs of us, because she's deeply invested in the relation. He's behind it because he can't do relation. Right? He can, and in as much, I love how you think about this alternative theological tradition, but the normative one sees God as a voyeur. The normative one sees God, him, as sitting high and looking low. Right? So what do you do with a God who can sit high and look low and then get pissed at you for doing things that he has created you to be capable of? So we have to ask ourselves, you know, I love how you bring in this alternative tradition, and that alternative tradition it speaks to another alternative tradition that Jessica and I were talking about during the podcast, that Toni Morrison takes us to in The Clearing of Beloved. Right? There's just something about, you know, a certain kind of sociality that says, look, there are no subjects here. Mm-hmm. But a pornographic gaze can't do that. Mm-hmm. It has to emphasize sensation without feeling. It needs this critical distance. It needs a certain kind of impassibility, to use a theological term. And that's exactly what you see at Warhol. Basquiat's hugging him.
Yeah.
And he's...
Yes, right. It's dead such eyed. A disturbing echo of the slave family pictures, family pictures.
Absolutely. Earlier, right? Absolutely. Yeah. So I just wanted to think in relation to these two themes. So yeah, that's...
So I are you guys game to open up?
Oh yeah, how are you now?
Because I have more questions, but let's pause. Make your question succinct and brief, and I'm going to restate it just because we're recording things. Yes, at the back, left.
In Warhol's relationship with Basquiat, he seemed to be participating in magical name throwing and using a Basquiat for his own hero's journey as a muse. And I guess my question would be, how going forward in a view of diversity for image and Glenn and all of the above, do we not participate in sort of a wider tent, but in a way that we're really just magically subpopulations for a larger white hero's journey?
Yeah, so the question is a little bit like, this is slightly putting words in your mouth, but how do eager white liberal Christian arts communities who want to be the best that they can not end up unintentionally replicating the Warhol-Basquiat relationship? That's kind of the question, right?
Well, my funny answer to you, and it's an answer that is said tongue-in-cheek because it's partly serious, is if I actually had the answer to your question, I'd be a millionaire. I don't really have an answer to that question because I don't know that the country allows for that kind of relation unless we did a full-on deconstruction of the structures of this country. And so the best that we can... so the best that we can do, I think, in spaces like this, is to do exactly... in a different way, but to listen to Jessica here and see possibility beyond the frame, to see what is opened up, not simply what is foreclosed or excluded. You mentioned white liberals. White liberals are great at crying. And I'm not trying to be shady when I say that. I'm trying to say that white liberals are great at emoting at the spectacle of black suffering, speaking of Saadia Hartman. But it becomes incredibly difficult to move past that cathartic emotional release to simply see blackness and black art as a space of possibility. Mm. Would you like to say more about that? But that's hard to do. And so, like, you know, part of it is just sitting here and figuring out. I mean, I don't know what that looks like in this space. I do know that what it doesn't look like is my career's taking a left turn. I'm doing lobster paintings. And here comes this black boy who does drugs that I cannot. But I'm scared off by the blackness, right? It's not simply the addict, right? Because opioid epidemics are here now. We're all for therapy. But in the 80s, it was another story, right? So it's not simply the drugs. It's the blackness that repels Andy until he realized this boy can draw. This boy can draw. And so I think the best that we can do when we see pieces or when we see opportunities for relation is to sit, as Levinas tells us, and be hospitable. That's the end. Hospitality. That's the welcome. And then we figure out what happens once we walk in your house. You know, because everybody's food ain't the same. You know, so you have to... You know, you have to think about that, what happens after. But right. Open the door, right. And then we have a conversation about what happens as we walk in.
You're singing from Lisa Cockrell's hymn book here, too, on hospitality. It's funny, because I do think this is next year, if you come back. I've been struck, even in these few days in Santa Fe, you see the dynamic of... There's a certain parallel dynamic with the role that indigenous art plays in the Santa Fe art community, which is, okay, what exactly is going on with the appropriation of, how exactly is indigenous art functioning in this space? And I think it often comes from a space of wanting to celebrate and say, I enjoy this, but the subtlety of that looking like then appropriation and exploitation is that's the hard space that we're working through. Yes.
I'm going to ask you to finish what you feel the pressure and discomfort of.
So a pedagogical question, in a way, of what does it look like, maybe especially in for teachers, white teachers, let's be honest, to incorporate artists, writers of color into context. That, yeah, riff on.
I think that my experience with that has been, you know, well-meaning professors who want to make sure that they have kind of checked all of the people of color sexuality boxes. And what becomes clear is that they may check off those boxes, and I see those people show up on the syllabus. I have no issue with white folks teaching black stuff. My problem is when it's not taken up with rigor, right? And this goes back to the point that I was making earlier about black art always and already being defined and critiqued and approached as protest art, right? That's been done, and that's in a sense sort of low-hanging fruit at this point. What else can we glean from black art? Are there? I mean, my issue is there's not a kind of rigor that is approached when we handle black art, that the meanings of black art, black literature, anything involving black people, is that it is often just an over-determined, easy interpretation. So I have no issue with white folks taking that stuff up. I just really want white folks to do their homework on this work and really show that they have gone the distance. And that's not knowing everything, right? But it's creating a space in your classroom that sets the tone with your students, your graduate students, whomever, that says that this work is worth really wrestling with, right? And grappling with in significant ways. So I don't know if that's helpful.
Not truncated to get into the Black Week, right? I mean, that's part of it.
Yeah.
You know, so part of it is I probably shouldn't say this because it's being recorded, but what the hell? I have a colleague who teaches graduate work, and you know, the beautiful work. There's such close attention to certain theoretical folks, and then we get to Frantz Fanon, and it's just this week. And it's like, oh, okay. Like now we're gonna turn to Ray.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I was just gonna, because the other piece too is, and it's precisely what you're talking about. But you know, the question would be, you know, what one of the issues I think that black artists face is that they are put into sort of black art, and that's fine. I have no problems with black art, but we don't talk about the implications of black art for modern art, right? For some of the forms that are put out and how black art is disrupting some of those. So I'm actually okay with putting us in that week, but just make sure you connect us to the larger kind of themes that are happening and how black artists, black, you know, musicians, literature, how are they disrupting, talking in response to, expanding on, providing something totally different from these sort of normative canons that we engage.
And Kenny, if I can just riff off of that real quick, like one thing that you're pointing out here is that in terms of syllabi construction or syllabus construction, if you have to name the Black Week, you got to name it in a pretty expansive way, or just don't name the Black Week, right? Like there's a way, and I won't say don't name the Black Week, but I mean in certain ways, if you say, all right, we are now making our shift to identity. We have been reading these incredible poets and writers and Walt Whitman, and let's sit with his one poem for 2 weeks, right? And then June Jordan gets half an hour. Like how do you think about the kind of care, again, this hospitality question? How do you, as you so beautifully put it, how do you allow for that work to speak back to, with care and rigor, speak back to these other conversations that are happening? Because as Lanicia told us last night, Ed Clark is in Paris, right? These folks are across the pond. James Baldwin is in France. He's talking to these folks. And so there's a very real way in which this artist is being in conversation with these folks, even as it critiques and expands and goes beyond.
This has been so rich and fantastic. Thank you so much for the time. Please join me in thanking Jessica and Biko.